Hi, everybody. My name's Mary Robinson, and I'm an alcoholic. And I talk real soft, but I sound real loud. Am I too close to the mic? Okay. There's a lot of sobriety here in this room. I tell you what, for me, that's just a lot of hope. You know, when I see people who've got 20, 30 years of sobriety, that just gives me hope. I know that their life hasn't been a bed of roses, but they've applied the steps in their life and made it through hard times. So this is a neat conference here. I want to thank the committee for inviting Doug and I down. I know that there's a lot of work goes into these conferences. We're on the committee for a couple conferences back home, and I know that there's a lot of work goes on to get these going. My sobriety date is February the 27th, 1988. And for me, that's the most important thing I'm going to say tonight. My home group is the Edgewood Group in Charleston, West Virginia. And if you're ever in the area, I think it's the best group in the world. And I hope you all feel that way about your home group, too. I think I've thought a lot about that. If I had come to Alcoholics Anonymous and not got a home group, I really don't think I'd be here tonight, because this was a place that these people got to know me, and they kind of knew when I was headed down the wrong road before I knew I was going, and helped me. And so I think a home group is real important. I think a sponsor is real important. And I guess I kind of hang on to, I have learned just enough in Alcoholics Anonymous to stay sober. I don't tend to be I hear people and they talk, and I think it's wonderful, but I'm just real simple, you know. I hang on to the very basics, and I have a sponsor, and what I have found with this sponsor, she's been pretty rough on me at times, but she was someone I could talk to and someone I could trust, and today she's probably the dearest friend in my life. So it's Alcoholics Anonymous has given me so much. When Doug and I were asked to come down, and we were talking about a few days before, you know, having the time to drive down here, and it was a pretty good distance, but not as far as New York, and we would have some time. Our life's real busy, and you know, if you're busy in Alcoholics Anonymous and you have a family, your life's real busy too, you know. And we were looking forward to that time, but what I found is a lot of that time we just were sitting there. Maybe we just needed some quiet time. But anyway, I was born in down in the southern part of West Virginia in a little town called Madison, and it was in the coal fields, and my daddy was a coal miner. And my mom was a Baptist. And my dad liked to drink, and my mom didn't allow it in the house. And I was the baby of our family, and that didn't make me anything special, because I was number 11, and I was the seventh girl in a row. And I never, at an early age, that mom had, she had a daughter and three sons, and then she had seven more girls, plus she raised a granddaughter from birth. So really, the last eight of us were girls. And I can remember just kind of waiting to get a bed, praying that somebody get married, because I was 6 years old when I got out of the crib bed. And but... You know, I never felt like I fit in that family from a very early age. I always felt like that, I felt like a grandchild. And looking back, I know they didn't mean to treat me that way. It was the way I felt inside. And I adored my older sisters. I always wanted to be like them. I wanted to be as pretty as they were, and build as cute as they were, and be as popular as they were. And I never really wanted to be me. And this started real early in my life. I can remember buying a dress just like they would buy, and I'd put the, if I'd borrowed their dress, I'd feel good in it, and if I'd buy one my own, I didn't feel like feel very good in it. So it was just an inside thing that I never felt as good as anybody else, or I never seemed to fit in. We went to church on Sunday morning, just like we went to school on Monday morning, and that was mandatory in my house. My dad drank, but there was never, ever a can of beer or anything that sat in our house because my mom just absolutely did not allow it. So, you know, it wasn't like that my mother didn't teach me a lot of good morals. It was always said that morality and decency, we may not have a lot, but morality and decency came free in our home. I was 13 years old when I tasted alcohol, and it wasn't in my home. At an early age, I wanted to do things that I wasn't supposed to do. And I had gone to this place about 12 miles on up the holler, this little town called Van, me and two other girls, and I absolutely was not allowed to go to Van because this, and I always believe this is where the best looking guys in the county lived. So we sneaked off and went up to Van, and we got this guy to go in this little place called The Hut and ask him to buy us a beer. And he brought out a Black Label. And we opened that beer and passed it around, and I didn't like that. We threw it away and nothing happened that night. But somewhere in my high school years, I started liking beer, and I liked it a lot, and I could chug with the finest. But you see, I lived in this little town that was like Peyton Place, and I had to be very, very careful because I was afraid of my parents, but today it was just good, healthy respect. You know, I was afraid, and they found out a lot of things. So I had to be real careful. When I was a senior in high school, I graduated on Tuesday night. On Thursday night, I turned 18. And on Saturday night, I had a big church wedding at Madison Baptist Church. And my life's always kind of been like that. It's been busy. And anyway, so after I got married, I told you I always watched my sisters and wanted to do everything they did. And here's what I saw about religion with my sisters. It was my perception was the ones that didn't seem to go to church were the ones back then. If you didn't go to a big beer joint in our area, then you had to go to a club like the Owls Club or something. You had to have membership in Charleston. And I'd hear them talk about that, and then they didn't go to church on Sunday morning. And then the ones that did go to church, you know. So that's what I did. When I drank, I didn't go to church. And so I was married about 4 months and started getting sick, and then I realized that I was expecting our first baby. And my first anniversary, my baby was 2 weeks old, and so we started, you know, going to church because that's the way I was raised. And then we moved to Charleston, and I tried to find a church there, and it wasn't like the one I'd been raised in. And so we joined the Moose, and I got an office in there, and we just drank. But you know, I didn't have a problem. When I drank for, as I look back on it, I drank for the effect. But I, you know, I didn't have that phenomena of craving, you know, at that time. And in the next 7 years, I had 3 children. And I truly loved being a mother, and I loved participating in my kids' life. When my son was born, my husband lost his job. They had a layoff, and we ended up moving to Cincinnati. And at the time, we hadn't been going to church, and he had gone on, and my sister was taking me and the 2 little ones out. Chad was 5 months old, and before I left on Saturday, Mom's preacher called, and he said that he wanted to talk to me before we left. And so he took me in the back room, and he said, "Now, Mary Catherine," he said, "the larger cities are the gateway to hell." And he said, "I want you to find a church and get in it and get active." And you know, I did just exactly what that guy said. I went to Cincinnati, and I found a church, and I got active. The neat thing about moving out there for me was that every time I met somebody and told them who I was, they did, in Madison, they would say to me, "Oh, you're June's little sister," and "Oh, you're John's little sister," and "Oh, you're a Watson." Oh, I didn't know they had another one. That one always was real good for my... And I went to Cincinnati, and I could have my own identity. I could just be me. And I moved in that little town of Milford, and I became active in the PTA. I was a Brownie leader. We were active in church, and for 5 years, I didn't have a drink of alcohol. And we had some problems at church, and the church split, and I made this decision that I could teach my children at home, that I didn't need any organization or anything to teach my children. And my husband, my ex-husband now, he always liked good cold beer. Now, he never drank the way I did when we partied, but he liked a good cold beer. And so one day he brought in some beer and put it in the refrigerator, and I was devastated. I said, "You know, the kids have never been exposed to this." And after a while, one Saturday night, he asked me, he said, "Mary, why don't you have a beer with me?" He said, "You know, one beer won't hurt you." And that was really true. One wouldn't. The kids were in bed, and I had a beer with him that night. I've heard people say that their first drink, something happened. I can tell you something happened to me that night. I don't know how many beers I drank, but I can tell you that in the next 18 months, I became a daily drinker very quickly, and in the next 18 months, my husband had moved out. I have decided that he was not the father that I wanted him to be to my children. He moved back to West Virginia. I said I would come later, and about 3 months after he left, I filed for divorce. I drank every opportunity. I drank when it talks in the big book about times that, you know, when we're planning to be someplace. I spoiled everything for my kids. My kids really did not know what was happening to me. After about 18 months out there, and our divorce was final, I asked my ex-husband, because I had got the car, and I asked him if I could, if I could put the house up for sale and move back home, because everything that I had built for me in that town I had destroyed. And I thought if I would just get out of here and didn't have the pressure of these three children, then I wouldn't have to drink like I do. And so I called my ex-husband, and he told me that I could put the house on the market. And so I moved back to West Virginia. Now, somewhere in this process, we started talking more frequently, and we ended up getting married. And I used to tell in meetings, or if I gave a lead early on, I would say that was the worst mistake I ever made in my life. And tonight I'm here to be honest, and that was the worst mistake that man ever made in his life, is when he married me. And we had the opportunity to buy this business that had laid him off, and the reason we had gone to Cincinnati. And, you know, I always wanted to be somebody. You know, I was just a wannabe. I wanted to be like my sisters. I wanted to have something. I wanted the big house and the big car. And if I just had all of these things, then I would be okay. And we had the opportunity to buy this business. And he really wasn't sure that this is what he wanted to do. But he was the printer. And so we took everything we had, you know, got in the last 13 years as equity in our home, and we put up against this bankrupt business. And all we bought was the good employees and the good name. So when we moved back here, then it was hard work. And we couldn't afford those union employees to pay them all the overtime, and they needed their job. And we would go back in every night and every weekend. And I would go home and see the kids and turn around and change my clothes and go back out. And I would say to myself, you know, if you had to do this, you would drink too. And if only I could just be home with my kids. And So I always had a reason. If your life was like mine, you would drink too. Needless to say, coming back to West Virginia, I used to tell people that I wanted to come back so I could spend more time with my mother. And I loved my mother dearly. She was just a dear friend of mine. My mother died really not knowing what happened to me. I came back and I didn't want to go around her drinking, so therefore I didn't go around very often. And she died before I got sober. And I can remember I could not go to the funeral home because until I had something to drink. And I remember the one time I said to my husband, I said, "I'm begging you, just go get me something to drink." And he said, and he didn't argue with me. But I can remember going there and bending over and telling her, "I promise you I'm going to do better. I just promise you I'm going to do better." And all, you know, like every other alcoholic that I've heard their story, the longer you drink, the worse it gets, and that's what kept happening to me. And what would happen, my ex-husband would try to control my drinking. He didn't understand either what was happening either. And he would try to count the drinks I had. And, you know, if we had a good day at work, he'd want to go home and get some things done. Well, I wanted to celebrate. If we had a bad day at work, you know, I wanted to drink over it when I went home. And occasionally he would drink over that. But he didn't understand what was happening. And the pressure he would try to put on to me about how much I was drinking and how often I was drinking. And what I would do is just start this big argument, you know, with him, and I'd just leave. And he always referred to them as my mini vacations. And I would go check into a motel. And, you know, we were a business owner in town. And so I couldn't go to the Marriott. Nobody knew me in town, I can tell you, because I wasn't seen very often. I was in that business, and I was drinking, and I wasn't out much. And when I was out, I humiliated him to death. I mean, we couldn't attend anything. But anyway, I would take these mini vacations and I would go check into a motel. And I would take all the beer and the wine. And I really liked vodka, but you know, vodka always did a number and always brought so much wrath that I thought if I drank wine, and I started out drinking rosé wine. And I drank so much rosé wine that my lips turned like a purplish red, and I would try to get a washcloth in the morning and wash that off, and I'd put lipstick on to cover it, and during the day I'd go past a mirror and there'd be those big rosy lips. And so I thought, well, if I just switch to rosé, you know, that's a little lighter red wine. And I did that, and then on to Chablis, and I had all the side effects of wine too. And I loved beer. You know, I've heard a lot of alcoholics say, you know, they didn't consider beer a drink. But now beer was a drink for me. I liked it, and I got just as drunk as the next one did on it. And so anyway, I'd take these mini vacations, and I would go check into a motel, or I would either go out to my niece. I have a niece that Susie was born May the 3rd, my brother's girl, and I was born May the 25th. And we're as close as twins. And Susie kind of did her life the way I really planned to do mine. She got married and had children, and she's stayed married, and she's, raised them in the church. And that was what I was taught by my mother, you know, and that's the way I thought I would do. But so I would go out to her house, and she would tell me when I was sober that Gary, her husband, said that I could come out anytime I wanted to, but not to come out there when I was drinking. And, of course, the only time I really wanted to go was when I was drinking late at night. And so I would go out there, and she would spend her time hiding the beer cans because he worked midnights. And she said I would always just be so scared that one of those garbage bags was going to rip when he took it out, you know. And she'd go out and put my car. I'd stop in the middle of the road. She'd put my car in. This girl went all the way to the end with me. I mean, she begged and she pleaded, and I guess she thought those would be the answers for me. And I heard her. You know, I just couldn't do anything about it, and she couldn't understand that. Or I would check into a motel, and I'd stay for 2 or 3 days, and I would come home, and when I would walk in, those three kids that I had been such a good mother to literally looked at me with just, when I first started doing this, I'd come in and they would say, "Mom, where you been? And Mom, why'd you leave?" And you know, I'd have all that guilt and that remorse, and I wanted to be a different person, and I didn't know what was happening to me. And it became often enough that I would come back and I would walk in and they would just turn their heads and go on to their room. And it started, you know, alcohol started really changing my personality. I would be drinking in the evenings and laughing and joking with the kids, and you know, it would be in a matter of an hour, I'd be a totally different person, and I'd be arguing with them and picking on them. And I can remember hearing their bedroom door slam, you know, just to get away from me. And anyway, I kept thinking if that business would just turn around, everything would be okay. And that business turned around. And matter of fact, we came to West Memphis, Arkansas. I was telling Mel to the dog track over there because we got the printing contract for the new racetrack in Crosslanes, West Virginia. And I had to be drunk to do that. We were running a print shop that, if anybody knows anything about it, was all hot metal, and it was all obsolete, and only a drunk could have ever bid on that contract. We didn't have one piece of equipment to run that with. And the only thing we had going for us was I knew one of the guys, one of the owners of the track, and we got that $250,000 a year contract. And I kept saying to my husband, if we get the contract, then we can talk. You know, we can talk to the banks. But anyway, so we came to West Memphis and, you know, looked at that printing operation and that track. It was at a time when I was drinking, so I don't remember a lot about Memphis or West Memphis or the track or anything else. But that business turned around and we started making money. We made more money than I'd ever seen. And nothing changed for me. Not one thing changed. I just continued to be the same person. I continued to drink. And I can remember drinking in the mornings and sitting on the end of my bed and looking out the window. And if you look out my bedroom, what used to be my bedroom window, there was this farm and these horses. And I can remember sitting there and saying, why am I like this? You know, why am I doing this? I didn't know what was happening to me. And my ex-husband told me, he said, this was like in 86, he said, Mary, he said, if you don't quit drinking, he said, after Christmas, I'm going to leave. And you know, those were like magical words to me. If he'd just get out of my life, he's the reason I drink. You know, if he'd just get out of my life, I wouldn't have to tolerate him. And I wouldn't have to drink like this. And I believed that. And he did just what he said he was going to do. In January, he moved out. And I can tell you that the next 13 months, the big book talks about the curtain going wide open. And I'm telling you, the next 13 months, I worked very little. I spent most of my time, my days in the bed, and I would drink to sober up. You know, I had these grandiose ideas. I thought if we bought this one business and it did well, then we'd buy these other businesses and we'd build this empire, you know. And so he came home one day and he said to me, he said, we have the opportunity to buy another print shop downtown. And you know, I can remember that, you know, these moments of clarity. I know where I was standing at the kitchen sink and I thought, I can't do it. There's something wrong with me. And I said, I don't want no part of it. And he didn't seem to appreciate my opinion in any way at that time. And so the only thing that I knew was he said, you be at the bank this time. And I was always afraid not to do some of the things he told me to do because I really didn't know what I'd done the night before and what I'd said the night before. But I ended up at the bank closing the deal out on that business. And it was just a little offset print, quick print down in town Charleston. And I always felt like I was the business person and he was the printer. And I never gave him much credit for much smarts, you know. But I found out that he was pretty darn smart, because what he bought that little print shop for was to get me out of our business. And I was the first one transferred. So I was kind of down there, away from everything, you know. And one morning, it was about June in 87, we had met this couple in Cincinnati in a church, in the church pew, Kathy and Randy. And we had gone to church with them, we had quit church with them, we had drank with them. They got transferred to Nashville, and we went back to Charleston. We stayed in touch. We'd go down on New Year's and drink. He'd bring his guitar, and we'd pick and sing, and we'd have cases of beer, you know, that high, and it just have the best time. Well, Randy called me, and it was one of those days where I was still in bed about 11:30, and I hadn't heard from him for a while. And Randy says, Kathy and I are getting a divorce. And I said, how come? And he said, well, Kathy told me that if I didn't quit drinking, that she was going to divorce me. And I told him, you might as well get a divorce. He said, I ain't never going to quit drinking. And I thought, right on, you know, I'm not either, buddy. And so we just, you know, had the biggest high. I told him Butch had left in January, and we just had this wonderful conversation. So he was a good friend to my husband and me both, and he said he was going to come to town and see us. And I didn't hear any more from him until October. And my life is continuing to go down. I can tell you that alcohol stripped every bit of morality and decency that my blessed mother had shown and taught me. It took every bit of it away. In October, I got a phone call, and it was Randy. And he wanted to know how things were going, and things were bad. You know, things were just bad, and that's like they were in June. And Randy told me, he said, Mary, he said, I think I've found a way to stay sober. And he had been sober 10 days. And I said, how's that? He said, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, I said, well, you do. Because, you know, I believed with all of my heart that if you ever took alcohol away from me, you were going to have to put something back in me. Because I had been, my husband had taken me to the doctor kind of like this one time and said, we're going to get something done, because I was vomiting up blood. And, you know, being the con artist that we are, by the time we got there, I promised him faithfully I'd tell that doctor everything if he'd just not go in with me. And he believed me again. And so I came out of there with some antidepressants, I think, you know, and he told me, the doctor said, well, alcohol's a depressant. Said, what you need's an antidepressant. Well, you know, that didn't get it. I didn't take those long enough. Now today in the profession I'm in, I know you have to take them for 3 weeks to even get them in your system. Well, I can guarantee you there wasn't 3 weeks ever in my system. And what it did, it would make me go to sleep. So when I wanted to be good, I'd take one of those, you know. And I didn't want to be good very often. I don't know if I ever used a prescription of them or not. But anyway, that's what I felt like you were going to have to do. You're going to have to put something in me if you take that away from me. And Randy told me that at an Alcoholics Anonymous, now I'm sitting on the phone in Charleston, West Virginia, and he says, what we do is you go to meetings, you ask God for help, you read the big book, and you don't drink. And I'm like, hello? You just don't understand, Randy. You don't drink like I do, you know? You just don't drink like I do. Even though I knew he drank a lot, but he just must not feel like I felt. Well, anyway, that didn't, you know, do too much. But he never left me alone. He kept calling. Nothing changed for me. But he kept calling and asking me to come to Nashville. And Kathy had divorced him. And he kept begging me to come down. He said, come down and go to a meeting with me. Well, that was out, you know, because I wasn't going to ask for help. Anyway, to me, that was a sign of failure. It was a sign of weakness, you know. And here we were, these prominent people in Charleston. We owned a business. People who knew me would have been glad to see me do something. But I saw it as a sign of weakness. And my husband used to say that every now and then he would tell me, he'd say, Mary, he said, if you don't quit drinking, I'm going to have you committed. And that would scare me so bad. And I would look at him as belligerent as I could and tell him that would be a welcome rest, you know, but it would scare me so bad. And I told you that I had 11 in my family. And by this time in my life, I had drank away everybody except Susie. I had a brother that still come around me and one sister. And nobody else, matter of fact, for years, spoke to me. And so anyway, that last Christmas in 87, Susie called me and she said, "Ethel's not coming to Christmas dinner this year." Now, Ethel had been one that had kind of hung with me. And, you know, we had drank a lot together. We had gone on vacations and drank. The only difference between she and I is she still lived life. I didn't. You know, I drank, and you never knew what I was going to do, when I was going to quit, what was going to happen. And she was going to play tennis 3 days a week like she did. She was going to keep her commitments. So I wanted to believe that if I had a problem, she had a problem. But she told Susie the last Christmas, she said, "I'm not coming." She said, "I just can't take it anymore." And so in February, my daughter was getting ready to in March, was due with our first grandchild. And, you know, she kept begging me to go to the doctor with her and hear the heartbeat. Well, I had worked for this doctor for a year and a half when we came back to Charleston before the business could afford for me to go to work in it. And I promised her, you know, each visit I would go and each visit I couldn't go. And so this one particular day, she said, "Mom, if I make my appointment in the afternoon," she said, "will you promise me you'll try to go?" And so I went with her. And I heard that heartbeat. And I knew in my heart that when that baby was born, that she was not going to let me come around it. And when I went in, the doctor that I had worked for when I came back did not recognize me. And so we left there. And the whole time, Randy is still calling me about every 10 days to 2 weeks. And I went back to that little print shop downtown, the only one that I was really allowed in at this time, to spend any time. And there was a guy came in, and he had this little pamphlet, and he said, and it threw it on the counter, and he said, "Can you print this for me?" And I picked it up, and it said, 15 points for an alcoholic to consider when confronted with taking a drink. And I looked at it and I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well, print me about 50 of those." And I said, "Okay." So I wrote up the ticket and took it back and put it on the typesetter. And when nobody was looking, I took it to the copier, made me a copy, and put it in my purse. And when I went in that evening, nothing was different. I poured me a drink. And at about 9 o'clock that night, I called Randy. He said, "Well, Mary Catherine," he said, "I hadn't prayed for you and Butch and the kids for a long time, and I prayed for you all tonight." And I told him, I said, "You know, I think I'm going to try to come down." And I said, "There's only one thing, Randy." I said, "I can't not drink." He said, "I understand." I said, "But I mean, I can't not drink." And he said, let me just tell you something. He said, "You can drink all you want while you're down here." He said, "The only time that you can't drink is when we go to the meeting. Now, it's during the meeting." He said, "But if you can't make it an hour," he said, "you can put a bottle in the truck and you can go out and get your drink." And you know, that made it okay with me. So that was a process in itself. This was like the most secret mission to ever be performed. There was nobody, absolutely nobody, to know what I was going for. I didn't know. I look back on it, and I guess I thought I was going to Nashville, get healed, come home. And so Susie was going to keep my kids, and my oldest daughter, Nikki, that was pregnant with our first grandbaby, She was going to help with the kids to get them to Susie's, and that was it. That was it. Absolutely nobody else was to know. So I went through a week of not being able to get to the airport. I'd call Randy, I'll be down Monday. And I couldn't get to the airport to get my ticket. And this went on, I'll be down Wednesday. And I couldn't get to the airport because you had to pick your ticket up 24 hours in advance, you know. And I couldn't get out of bed to do it. And on Thursday morning, Nikki called and she said, Mom, you've got reservations for Friday at 1. She said, are you going to go pick your ticket up today? I said, I can't do it. She said, Mom, I'm begging you, let me tell Dad. Please let Dad go pick. She was going to put it on American Express, and Nikki couldn't use that. I said, no. Finally, she cried, and she said, Mom, I'm begging you from the bottom of my heart, please let Dad go pick that ticket up. So my ex-husband did go pick it up, and on Friday when they came to pick me up and take me to the airport, and I was standing there drinking, and Nikki said, Mom, I can't believe that you're going to Nashville to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you've got a beer in your hand. I said, well, I ain't going to get on that airplane without a drink. And when we got to the airport, when they called my flight, I got up and I walked over, and there was all these tears dripping down her cheeks. And she looked at me, and I had gone through my kid's life like a tornado. And she looked at me, and she said, Mom, I love you. And I said, don't expect miracles. They don't happen anymore. And that's the way I felt. I was gutted inside. I had no hope. I had nowhere to turn. I had no one left, hardly at all, in my life. And so I got on that plane, and I drank all the way to Nashville. I had a nice layover in Charlotte, and I sat in the bar, and I came skipping off that plane in Nashville, and Randy was there to pick me up. He lived in Smyrna, and he quickly took me and fed me. And when we pulled up in front of that church, I was devastated. And he said, now, don't start. He said, this ain't no church meeting. He said, we just meet in the church house. And I said, okay. And so when we walked in, and there was some benches right there at the door, and we walked in, and I sat down in that first seat, and he got a hold of me, and he pulled me up, and he said, come on, you come on up front. He said, you're here to get sober. That's where people sit trying to get their driver's license back. And I got up and went up front. And, you know, I was so nervous and so scared. And, you know, you say I don't really remember anything that I heard that night. But I remember what those people talked about was how I felt inside. I mean, they were just talking about all these feelings and all these fears. And I remember that there was a guy in a suit there, and there was a guy in bib overalls, and it was just so neat. I mean, it was, and I can remember the slogans. I remember let go and let God, because when I came back, I said to Susie, there was even these like little signs up there. One of them said, let go and let God. She said, that's good. She said, but anyway, and after the meeting, I had to drink, and he asked me, and he took me to get something. And then he took me to his ex-wife's house, and I spent the night there. And the next day, we drove around Smyrna, and it was about 1 o'clock, and I said, Randy, I believe I'm going to have something to drink. And he didn't argue with me. He took me to the liquor store. But he said, now we're going to a meeting tonight. And we went to Murfreesboro to a speaker's meeting. And that girl's name was Mary. And the only thing I remember about her talking about was she said she drank at her husband. And I thought, gee whiz, that's what I did. I drank at that man. I was trying to get him, you know, just drinking. When he'd tell me something or try to count my drinks, I just drank that much harder, you know. And if he'd get out of my life, things would change. And of course, they didn't. I flew home on Sunday morning. Randy gave me a big book and all the stuff, pamphlets and things. And the only thing that he asked me when he hugged me, he said, Mary, I want you to make one promise. He said, I want you to promise me that you'll contact somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous back there. So I came home and I showed, you know, the kids my stuff and my oldest daughter, and I called Susie and I told her all about it, and I felt good and I thought I had it licked. And that lasted till about 6 o'clock that evening, and I just couldn't do it anymore. And so that about six o'clock I left the house that evening, and that started a week-long drunk that I hope and pray to God is my last drunk. I didn't work any days that week. I stayed home. I drank. I drank like I always, and on Tuesday afternoon, I remembered what Randy had said to me, and I called. I looked up the number, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, that lady from the answering service, she called me back. She said, "Honey, I can't find nobody to take this call, but," she said, "I can guarantee you at 5 o'clock there will be somebody that will take this call. I'll have a lady to call you." I said, "That isn't no big deal. I'm just making contact with them. I didn't care if they call me right back or not." And at 5 o'clock that evening, this lady named Grace called me. And I was drinking, and she knew I was drinking. But you know what? She talked about herself and about things that she had done. And she was nice to me. You know, people weren't nice to me anymore. And people didn't look at me very... I mean, people looked at me with disgust when I walked around in the room. But this lady was so nice to me. And she just seemed to understand. And they were getting ready to go to a roundup, Cedar Lakes. And she asked me, she said, "Would you meet me and a friend tomorrow for lunch?" Well, I was drinking, and I said, "Sure, you know, I'll meet you." And boy, I'll tell you, if I'd have just had a phone number. But I met them the next day, and they brought me a Living Sober book, and she and Al, and I left there and went to the track. I did a lot of drinking at the dog track, and I went to the track and just got so drunk that evening. And when I come home, my ex-husband, well, we weren't ex at that time, but boy, we had got into a big fight. And I came in the house and I called Susie and I asked her if I could come out. And she told me, she said, "Now I'm going to tell you something." She said, "Gary's here." And she said, "You know how he feels about this." And I said, "But I'm trying. You know, I went to Nashville and da-da-da, you know." And she's crying on the other end. And she said, "Well, just let me call you back." And so she called me back. In the meantime, she told me this later. She said, "You know," she said, "I went in and I said, Gary," she said, "he said, Mary Catherine's drunk." And said, "And she wants to come out." But he said, "Now, Gary, I believe she's going to try." I said, and he said, no. And she said, "You know," she said, "I was so mad, and I walked back to the dryer at washer and started to put a load in," and said, I come back out and I looked at him and I said, "Gary, what do you think Jesus would do?" And she said, I turned around and walked off and said, he came back in that laundry room and he said, "Go ahead and go get her." And it got all settled, because by the time she called, I'd passed out. And all she had was a lot of trouble. And that seemed to be what I caused. But anyway, on Friday night, I had a friend that look at me, and he said, "You know, you're not even as good as your word anymore." And for some reason, on Saturday morning, February 27th, 1988, I got up, and I picked up that big book that Randy had given me. And my mind was as cloudy and foggy. I don't know what I read, but I read something that I didn't take a drink for a little while. And I made it through Saturday, and I made it Sunday. I felt better. And you know, then I thought, you know, I like to start things on Monday. And Grace called me when she came back to town, and she asked me to come to the meeting on Monday night. She said, it's an open beginners meeting. By the grace of God, I didn't take a drink, and I thought, you know, after I go to that meeting on Monday night, I'll drink. And, you know, when I turned that doorknob, that was the hardest thing I ever did, and walked into Alcoholics Anonymous on my own. But I can tell you that everybody, just like you people, have been so warm and friendly. That's the way the people in that room were. That was the nicest people had ever been to me for a long, long time. And I didn't believe that it was going to work. You know, I thought calling somebody before you take a drink is stupid, you know. And I'll tell you what happened to me. About 3 weeks, I had been going about, had about 3 weeks. And one night, I was sitting at the table, and it came my turn to talk. And you see, I always kept my stash, my wine, in the bottom of the goodie cabinet. It's this tall, long cabinet. And I always kept it there. And so I had moved it from there to the laundry room, and I felt like that was real progress. And I moved it from there to the garage. So 3 weeks sober, I shared that with the people in the room that night at the meeting. Bombs went off around the table, and they were telling me. This one guy said, I used to do all my drinking in the garage. And the other guy said, you know what? Said, you don't even have to think about it. You can just go down there and pick that bottle up. You better pour that out. I left that meeting, and I hated everybody's guts. I hated them. And I went home crying, and my oldest daughter's living with us. And she said, Mom, what's wrong? I said, I hate them. I hate them. They know everything. A week later, on Monday night, I got my 30-day chip. On Tuesday, my first grandbaby was born. And it was a miracle. I mean, you know, this was just one of the happiest days in my life. But my ex-husband and I didn't do well at the hospital. I mean, we were still married, you see. And we didn't do well at the hospital that day together. And it really caused a lot of problems in the waiting room to the people around there. And so anyway, I thought about it, and I stayed at the hospital. I knew I was going to drink. I mean, I knew I was going to drink. I was so mad. And so I thought, you know, I'll go by the shop, and I'll tell him I'm sorry. You know, so I went by the shop, and I told him I was sorry. And he proceeded to tell me what kind of, you know, and I got in my purse and got my 30-day chip and I threw it across that room. And I left. And I thought, I want to drink. You know, I knew what I was going to do. And for some reason, I went home and I thought, what? I mean, I was nuts. I was just crazy. So I went and got those pictures that I took of the baby being born developed. And I took them to his mother to show them to her. I didn't even go down there. I took them to show her. And I came back and I took Chad to ball practice, and I took Shelly to dance, and I'd done all I could do, and I brought her home, and I went down the garage, and I picked up that bottle, and I got in the car and left, and I went to the shop, because I did a lot of drinking in that shop, and my cups were still there, my ice was still in the freezer, and I made a phone call, and I tried to call Grace, and Grace wasn't there, and I thought, this don't work. And I sat there, and I cried, and I cried, and I picked up the phone, and I called my husband. And I said, please just help me not to take a drink. And he came down, and he got that bottle, and he took it over, and he dumped it out. He said, now go home. And I did. I went home, and you know what? I didn't drink. But the thing that I learned from that is that God will do for me what I can't do for myself. I have to take the action. This is a program of action. And I took the action, and I tried to call my sponsor. And I may not always get an answer right then, but someone will help me, and I know that. You know, when I had no idea when I got sober. I thought, I can remember sitting in the meetings the first few months, and you all share your stories, and I think, dang, you all have had all kinds of problems. But I was so drunk, and my mind was so messed up when I got here, I had no idea what problems I had. Because it was kind of like people didn't bother me when I was drinking. But now let me tell you something. When I got sober in February, this guy had been gone for about 2 years. But all of a sudden, he wanted me to really change. And I was in a lot of messes. And by November, he filed for divorce. I can remember Grace and Al took me to the lawyer, and I smoked really heavy. And when I got in Al's car, they didn't smoke, and Al said, I said, you can't smoke in here? And he said, only for funerals, Mary. He said, but this is almost like a funeral, said the ashtray's down under the seat. I don't know what I'd done without those two people. And everybody in my home group, one night I was just sitting in there, and I just, Oh, poor me. I was wrapped up in it. And this guy came over after the meeting and he said, boy, he said, you're really hurting, aren't you? And I said, yes. And he said, good. He said, you're growing. And you know, that's really the truth. Those are the times that I get, those times I get through and I don't take a drink. You know, today I know it's growth. But for the next 3.5 years, my first 3.5 years, I spent at the courthouse in Kanawha County. They did everything. He did everything from trying to take my children away from me. We went through 3 law masters and 2 circuit judges. And I would go in and they would say, his lawyer would always say, and this alcoholic wife of his. And the law master or the circuit judge would look and he'd say, and Miss Miller, how long have you been sober? And I can remember saying, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, and it was, and I'd say to Grace, it ain't ever going to get any better for me. I mean, everybody else and things, but you know what was getting better for me was right here. And all of this stuff out here, you know, was just chaotic and going crazy. But what was happening inside me, I could get up in the mornings and I could look at myself in the mirror. I could look at other people and I could remember what I said last night. I knew where I had been the night before. I could look at my children and that tell them that if they were going to do something, I could be there. Because I never, my son finished high scorer of the year in basketball in his 9th grade year. I never saw a game. In his last game, the neighbor next door called. And she said, Mary, she said, I'll take you, because she knew. She said, I'll take you to see Chad play. But you said, I'd already started drinking and I wouldn't go see him because I didn't want to humiliate him. And I'd sit across the road and watch that boy play baseball. And I'd sit across the road and look at the field and sit there and drink and watch him play. My daughter used to beg me to go in and watch her dance at night. And I always had a drink set between my legs and I couldn't go. But you see, then I started being able to go watch her cheer at football games and basketball games. And I started being able to participate in their life. I can tell you, the things that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is, there's no monetary value whatsoever. My children saw me, and the way I can make it up to my children is their children never have to see their granny take a drink, and they haven't, thank God, to this day. I've got 4 grandchildren, and, you know, there's just something different about grandchildren. But I'd been sober about 1.5 years, and I had taken Shelley to cheerleading camp and came home, and you know, I was out of the business now. I was sober and I wasn't allowed near the business because we were in this horrible divorce. And one day I picked up the newspaper, it was in August, and I didn't ask my sponsor this. I just looked at it, I went over the phone and I said, Nikki, will you go down to West Virginia State College with me and I might try to take a class. And she said, well, when did you decide this, Mom? I don't know. I'm scared to go by myself. So she had a baby that was 6 weeks old, and we took that baby and the little one that was 14 months old, and we went down there, and I signed up for a class, and I ended up taking 3, but you know, I was so scared because I thought, you know, I've drank all these brain cells away and I probably won't be able to learn anything. But to make a long story short, I went 2 years there and then I was accepted in St. Mary's School of Nursing. Now, when I was drinking, I always wanted to be a nurse. I mean, all my life I wanted to be a nurse. And I would get drinking and I'd write these schools where I'd call. And then I'd be drunk and I'd think, I'll never be able to do this. When we got to Charleston, I called UC and I called Garnets and I'll never be able to do this. And this was a dream come true in my life. You know, there's a lot of people don't get to do what they always wanted to do. And this is what, by working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life and taking a little action, that I graduated in 1993 as a registered nurse. And it was like every time I walked down that walk to that school and looked up, I thank God for my sobriety, because if I hadn't had my sobriety, I'd have never been there. I guess you find your niche as you go through. And I wanted, when I got out of school, I thought I wanted to be this wonderful, best labor and delivery nurse, and I sure didn't want to do that after I got out of school. And my niche kind of was oncology. And so I had got the last final, the week I got my acceptance into nursing school, I was going for another final. And my thought was, well, I've been to 50 finals. That's not going to be final. And it was the only time I left the courtroom crying, because I walked out of there. I knew I was accepted in nursing school, but I walked out of there and I had got the business, the building, the house. And my lawyer is running up behind me and he said, what's wrong? I said, you act like I got everything. I got all the bills. Yeah. But that business put me through nursing school. And so, you know, God has a way of giving you the energy to do the things you need to do. But I went to work on the floor as an oncology nurse. And no matter where I've gone in my life, God still works, you know. I'd just like to share a couple stories with you. We had... My sponsor says that we don't talk enough in Alcoholics Anonymous about alcohol being a deadly disease. And it is a disease that will kill you. And people come in and they go back out and they think, well, I'll come back, but I'm going to go drink for a while and come back. There's no guarantees when you walk out that door that you'll ever come back. Because Grace always told me, she said, we're the students, they're the teachers. They show us that it never gets better, it only gets worse. And I've watched that over a period of years. And I've waited for someone to come back and say, it's wonderful. And not one time, not one person has ever walked back and said it's better. They've always come back. Sometimes I don't recognize them when they come back. But we had this guy one night, they called us from one of the outlying hospitals, and they said that they were transferring a guy in with thrombocytopenia. That's low platelets, when you're clotting factor in your blood. And so we were the appropriate floor, oncology, hematology. And so when they started bringing this guy down on the gurney, I mean, the whole gurney was like shaken. And one of the nurses looked back and said, fever and chills? And they said, no, DTs. So the guy not only had that problem, but we ended up, within 24 hours, we had him in five-point restraints. And this was a 32-year-old boy that we kept him about 15, 16 days. We got his physical condition as far as the blood taken care of. But this 32-year-old boy is what the old-timers used to call a wet brain. He was never going to take care of himself again. He left there in a restraining jacket. And when I called his mom to tell him that we had to send him home because they were going to have to see about placement in one of the state hospitals, she said, well, said his daddy drank himself to death. I guess he has too. But you know what? Worse than dying would be living like that. And that I know that's out there for me if I take another drink. I know that could be me. I know how lonely the disease of alcoholism is. I know that anybody who's been through it, I've sat in a bar with all kinds of people and felt that loneliness. It didn't matter how many people, it was that fear inside of you in that big hole. And we had a patient one night, I had him, John, and John was brought in, and he was dying from cirrhosis of the liver, full-blown alcoholism. And I looked at him, and I thought, dear God, he'll be dead by morning. And I'm a night person. I'm a night creature. And I said, you know, the neat thing was I work nights at the hospital, and I stay out all night, and I got paid for it. And that's what changed in my life. But anyway, John, one night, when I passed him the next morning, I said to the nurse, I said, he'll be dead, you know, by this evening, because I worked 12 hours. Well, I came back on, and that went on for about almost 3 weeks. John didn't die. And what I learned out of that is dying from alcoholism is a very slow death. You know, it's not like you can take enough drugs and explode your heart. But when you die from alcoholism, it is a long, long death. And John had, he apparently had probably drank a lot of the financial means of the family away. But you know, his family still cared about him. In the days they couldn't come, they called. And one night when it was evident that death was imminent with John and they couldn't come, and I didn't want him to be in there by himself, and that I didn't have him as a patient that night, but it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, the nurse came in and she said, "What are you doing?" I said, I knew how lonely it could be to be an alcoholic. I said, "I want to stay in here." So I stayed. I said, "I just want to stay with him till he dies." And John died that night. And the next evening when I went to work, the charge nurse came to me and she said, "I just want you to know that John's 16-year-old son called today." And he said, "You know," he said, "what happened when my dad died?" She said, "Oh, we just took a couple breaths and he was gone." And he said, "Was anybody with my dad? It was real important to that boy. And no matter what John had done, that was his dad. And that's the way I look at my kids. You know, the things that we do and the forgiveness that they can find by us just changing our life." And, you know, I left about 5 years ago to hospital and I went to hospice. And that's what I do now. I'm a hospice nurse. I don't share this in a way of bloating in any way, but I am just telling you the things that have come my way since I haven't taken a drink and since I've stayed close to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I went my first caseload at hospice. In my very first 5 patients, I got Mary. And Mary was a recovering alcoholic with 11 years sobriety. And after I was there for a while, she was one of those kind of typical alcoholics. I'd go in before she got to know me and tell her to do something. She wouldn't do it. And then she called the doctor. She wanted to make sure what I was saying was right, you know. But after I was there for a while, I shared with Mary that I was a recovering alcoholic. And she would say to me, she said, "You know, I told my sponsor not to worry." She said, "Me and my little nurse said we have 3 meetings a week." And I always made Mary last so I could go and spend some time with her. And so, you know, it's the other person that I took care of was Denny. And Denny was an alcoholic that he had a smile. He had a contagious smile on his face. He was so grateful to be sober. And a matter of fact, my daughter, when she was externing on the floor, she said, "Mom, do you know Denny?" And gave his last name. I said, "Yeah." She said, "Oh, he is the nicest man." Well, he was just a very grateful recovering alcoholic. And we would share when I would go in to talk with Denny. And one Monday morning, I went in, and it was evident Denny was dying. And I took his wife to the side, and I said, "You know, he appears to be like he's going to be slipping into a coma." And I said, "If there's anything you need to say to him." And she just started crying so hard. And she said, "You got to do something for me." And I said, "What?" And she said, "They brought his 12-year chip." And she said, "You've got to give it to him." And so she went and got his 12-year chip. And I went in and I scooped Denny up in my arms. And I said, "Denny, I want to show you something that I've got for you." He got this great big smile on his face. And I said, "You know, I hope I get one of those someday." And then, you know what Denny told me? He said, "You will, if you just have the willingness. And if you just want to be sober just a teeny bit more than you want to be drunk, this program will work. If you just have the willingness." And you know what? In February, I got one of those chips just like Denny did because he told me the truth. I could just stand up here and go on and on. I tell you, my kids, we have a wonderful relationship. Doug and I got married 5 years ago. Doug said that when he came to Charleston in 91, he said, "Grace, who's that woman?" And said, Grace said, "Oh, she's going through a bad divorce." And Doug said, I said, "Well, she don't need no more problems." So in 94, I went to Bluestone conference, and I'd been going to it. I, I went to Bluestone. I'll tell you one other thing is after I got out of nursing school, my daughter went last one, went to WVU. I went to the bean dinner in November, and I didn't go back to another meeting until the next October. So I went 11 months without a meeting. And let me tell you what I know. I know from that, the nurses on the floor kept saying, let's go out and have a drink in the morning. And I said, no, I don't drink. And, you know, then it kept going, well, I could go with them. You know, one morning, I remember it was Friday morning, I was coming out the holler where I live, and I said, I couldn't remember my last drunk. And you all had told me that if you can't remember your last drunk, you probably haven't had it. And I couldn't remember it, and I went back to a meeting that night. And I'll tell you what, I've been faithful ever since. And I went to Bluestone in October, and that Doug was there, and he asked me if my divorce and everything was, and it was over, and so he asked me out. And so we got married about 5 years ago, and he's wonderful to my kids. I get tickled. He brought a cat, and I brought three kids and a son-in-law, and my kids call her the step cat. But we have a wonderful relationship for that. Everything that I have today, everything that I am, I owe to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And with that, I'm going to close.